The Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA as it is most commonly referred to, is the arm of the U.S. government tasked with protecting American interests both domestically and abroad. The CIA states its purpose on their website, and it reads in part this way: to accomplish its mission, the CIA engages in research, development, and deployment of high-level technology for intelligence purposes. As a separate agency, CIA serves as an independent source of analysis on topics of concern and also works closely with the other organizations in the intelligence community to ensure that the intelligence consumer, whether Washington policymaker or battlefield commander, receives the best intelligence possible. As changing global realities have reordered the national security agenda, the CIA has met these challenges by, and then they have several bullet points, but I just want to share this one bullet point. It says that they create special multidisciplinary centers to address such high-priority issues such as non-proliferation, counterterrorism, counterintelligence, international organized crime and narcotics trafficking, environment, and arms control intelligence. Lost in this smokescreen of high-level patriotic hyperbole is the fact that the CIA has a known history of utilizing international organized crime, narcotics trafficking, and arms sales to fund their off-the-record operations. Is that shocking? Well, it shouldn't be. For the overwhelming majority of Americans, it is. Stay tuned for my interview with John Adams for a detailed look at the CIA as drug lord and narco-democracy builders here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said. You talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome. This is the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. Follow us on Twitter, Soaring Eagle Rad. My guest today is John Adams, and he is returning to Soaring Eagle Radio. John is a host on the popular Drive Time podcast, Afternoon Commute Hoax Busters, and is a culture researcher and commentator. Welcome, John, to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing very well, John. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Pleasure to talk with you as well.
John, I mentioned to you many times before, but I want to give you a shout-out on the show. I very much appreciate you and Chris's show and the insights that you bring to topics that, for the most part, escape notice in American culture. And I think our topic today is one of those areas. When I say that the so-called war on drugs is a near total sham, I want to say it's a complete sham, but I'll leave a little bit of room there. Some folks might object to that by suggesting that we spend billions of dollars in drug awareness, education, law enforcement, and incarceration of offenders, and that this is somehow evidence that America is fighting a bona fide war on drugs. But I have the opinion that this is merely window dressing for what's really going on behind the scenes?
Well, yeah, it absolutely is window dressing. If you want to take it all the way back, the war on drugs is actually a war of drugs. And the war of drugs even goes back into the opium wars with China. The same families who were involved with those opium wars ended up being some of the families involved with the Skull and Bone Society at Yale. The Delanos, the Russells, people who started that society at Yale, which in turn, that society supplied a lot of the people who ended up being in the intelligence agencies like the OSS and the CIA. So connecting drug running and intelligence agencies is literally nothing new. And when you move it down into the modern day, I mean, just think of all of the programs that have been given to us. Like take for instance, out here in California, when I was growing up, we had something called the DARE program.
Yes.
Drug abuse rehabilitation education or something like that. I can't remember what the acronym was for, but
yeah, maybe drug awareness.
Oh, drug awareness, right?
Yeah.
And what that was successful in doing is, unbeknownst to I'm sure good police officers who would come around and thought they were doing a public service and that type of stuff, I'm sure unbeknownst to them, they were actually introducing children to drugs.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And so, that's what it did. They would come around to your school. They would show you what a joint looks like. They would show you what cocaine and heroin look like.
Yes.
And there you go. You're being introduced into the drug culture. Now, we have a drug culture. Our entire world culture is a drug culture now.
Yes.
And because most people are reliant on some form of drug already.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Many people are reliant on, to get through their day on psychotropic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Which psychotropic is pretty much psychedelic.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it was through the proliferation and the cultural change that was the psychedelic era, which wasn't even very long, pretty much over a 5-year time span.
Yes.
That the quote-unquote psychedelic era even existed, but mm-hmm. yet was able to shift culture entirely.
Yes.
And whether or not you physically participated in the drug culture of the 60s, your worldview was affected by it, and you yourself were affected by it, whether you took drugs or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just by you living through that and being exposed to that, you became more permissive, in a sense. We all did.
Yeah.
And it got passed down from generation to generation. If you want a good example is my parents. My mother has never touched a drug in her life, at least an illegal narcotic drug.
Mm-hmm.
And she said maybe once you went to a party where they might have smoking some pot.
Right.
And then on the opposite end, that is my father, who was what you would call in the classical terminology a stoner.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for him, he became a Christian in 1975 and stopped doing all that and never touched it ever again.
Yeah.
But both of them were affected by that culture and were changed by that culture and like I said, became more permissive, because there was a lot of things within culture. And I'll give a perfect example is you tend to look at the overt bad things, like take music, for example. You tend to look at something that is overtly satanic, right?
Yes.
Some heavy metal or some, you know, a lot of the pop stars today are overtly satanic and engage in a lot of openly satanic or Kabbalistic rituals on stage as they perform.
Right, yes.
But see, that is overtly out there. You can recognize that and you can say, okay, I am not going to ever let my daughter listen to Lady Gaga or listen to, you know, some heavy metal, death metal band or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Yeah.
But see, there is a much more insidious thing is a dialectical process. Is you say, you do that, but then you say, you know what's okay? It's okay to listen to this old music that I grew up with. And the old music that you grew up with is probably because it comes, you know, veiled in this idea of love or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. The lyrics and everything about it is changing you.
Yes.
As you're listening to it, and even though you don't identify it as that, you're being moved through the culture. So drugs. That's how drugs were moved through the culture. It became so prominent.
Yes.
That the background, the cultural wallpaper,
mm-hmm.
May,
yeah.
At a certain level, people were okay with it by say the 1980s.
Yes. Yeah.
It became passé.
Yeah.
There's a very famous song from the 1990s when I was a teenager. And it was the lyrics. It was by a band called the Dandy Warhols. And the lyrics are "Heroin is so passé."
Wow, yeah, that's a good example. I can think of another one, John, that speaks to exactly what you've been saying here. And insofar as music was used and still is used as a vehicle for changing people's minds and perceptions, whether they understand it or not, it is the dialectic process being engaged. On Wednesday nights, currently, I'm teaching through a series on yoga and the Eastern religious and philosophical foundations of yoga and what it really is. And as part of that, we've examined the history of its introduction into the West and how the Beatles were used to a large degree to introduce that, as well as the psychedelic drug culture. And they did that through music. And if you go back and you listen to some of that music today, many years later, the meaning is pretty clear what the message was. But at the time, we would just recite the songs and sing along with them. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, so didn't think a lot about it and sang those songs and didn't realize exactly what the message was. And that's part of what you're saying here, is that our minds and perceptions are changed even when we don't realize it.
Yes, absolutely. And like you're talking about yoga, the way that it was introduced into the West, it's not even introduced in its proper form. And it's usually accompanied by music and or some sort of chanting or rhythmic.
Yes.
If you were to go to a yoga studio, they would have music playing. And that's not how you do it
right.
In the traditional Eastern form.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's very pop. That's the thing. A lot of this stuff is, when it was introduced in the 60s, especially with Eastern religions and all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually spoke with a professor his name was Andre Zinomansky, and on one of our talks, we talked to him about the Tibetan form of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
That it is introduced into the West, and it has nothing to do with, it's more of a pop form of Buddhism that people have here in the West.
Yes.
And so what that is they know that when you bring something into a culture, and when I say they, I mean the people who control cultures. They are cultural creators.
Yes.
They will implement something that is the most foreign thing that you could possibly think of. Because it must be an absolute opposite to something that you could think of. So if you think of America in the 1950s and the early part of the 60s, something like Indian classical music and Indian culture is probably the most far removed thing from what you would think the nuclear family was.
Right.
And it's and there's a lot of stuff. It would probably be a much longer conversation if I was able to get to the particulars of that.
Yeah.
But you see, what was happening at that time, especially with rock and roll music,
mm-hmm.
and drugs play a part in that too, is as the culture was shifting, there was new things being introduced that separated the children from the adults.
Yes.
And there was direct marketing to what we call teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
The word teenager did not exist.
Yeah.
We use the word teenager very regularly. There was no such thing as a teenager before the late 1940s.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that word was used on purpose to separate adults from children and to directly market a teenage culture.
Yes.
To people from the age of 13 to 19.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get into the 1960s, they break it off even further to where now you have people so wrapped up in teenage and, you know, what later became young adult, another marketing term.
Yes.
Once they were able to totally shift that, now you're into stuff that is so foreign to your parents. Your parents are either going to do one thing, they're going to get really mad, and then you will in turn, it creates a crisis in your family, it creates a tumultuous relationship between you and your parents,
mm-hmm.
or they just don't even know what to do. They think you're from, you know, Planet Pop-Tart.
Yeah.
So they just reject it altogether, and they just say, you know what, he or she is going to do what it is they're going to do because I don't even understand them.
Yes.
And so one of the things that was played a prominent role in this was when they were introducing, marijuana's been around forever.
Yeah.
But when they were introducing it into American culture as something that was, popularized and generally known. They introduced a lot of catchphrases and cultural memes.
Yes.
Like, you know, don't trust anyone over 30.
Right.
It was all about being young. It was all about being modern. That was another word that was introduced in the late 1950s was young modern.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you always had to be modern. You always had to be up to date. And anybody who wasn't up to date was old. Fashioned. That was another word that was introduced
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to be old-fashioned. You wanted to be hip. And the word hip in and of itself, which transmutated into hippie.
Yes.
Do you know what the origin of the word hip is, Mike?
No. What is it, John?
It comes from the jazz age of the 1920s.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we still use the word hip today because a lot of millennials have been referred to as hipsters.
That's right, yeah.
Right? But see, the word hipster actually used to mean somebody who smoked opium. Okay?
No kidding.
back in the 1920s. Because a hipster, you see, in order to smoke opium, you lay down on your side and you smoke an opium pipe laying down on your hip.
Mm.
So somebody who was a hipster was somebody who smoked opium.
Wow. That's very interesting. Very interesting. Clearly, the folks, the millennials and others today, Christians especially, who think that they're being cool by referring to themselves as hipsters have no clue the origin of that word.
A lot of people don't, and like I said, hippie derives from it as well.
So. Yeah. So drugs were introduced, John, back in the 50s, late 50s or early 60s, to the youth culture predominantly. But research and development, and that may sound strange to describe it that way, but that's exactly what was going on, and even in the 40s, wasn't it? Research and development of these psychedelic drugs. And if I might add one other thing, and then I'll let you comment, John, it's my understanding that the CIA, when they understood or thought they understood the value of drugs such as LSD, saw that as a tool that they could use in their intelligence gathering, didn't they?
Absolutely. We just, on the afternoon commute, hoaxbusterscall.com, we just interviewed John Irvin the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And John Irvin's a researcher. He's wrote multiple articles, including a very good one called Manufacturing the Deadhead. He also wrote another one called Entheogens, What's in a Name? And he wrote another one that we recently interviewed him about that was called Spies in Academic Clothing. And these are all 70-plus page academic articles that he's gone through, and he's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I mean, like I said in the interview with him, if you go listen to that, I already knew a lot of this stuff myself, but it's always nice to have somebody cooperate.
Yes, that's right. And those episodes are available on the Hoaxbusters website, John?
That's correct. And see, the thing is, there is absolutely no doubt for anybody who's done any real research into it. I mean, just think of it offhand. Let me just ask you this question real quick, Mike.
Okay.
So the CIA knows about LSD, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they'll admit, and you can watch that on History Channel.
Yep.
But it just accidentally got out into the general population and yeah, proliferated, and the drug culture just accidentally through a grassroots movement proliferated.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We're supposed to believe that, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the story we've been given. That the phrase I like to use is that the CIA slipped on a banana peel, found LSD underneath it, and whoops-a-daisy, it accidentally got out into the general population.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen that way when you actually think about how things happen. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Yeah. Yeah. And we know the facts and the history. Hopefully you'll give our listeners some references as to books that you've read and researched, John, as we discuss this today. But I want to give them one right now that I've been reading, and it's a real eye opener. I know you're familiar with it because I believe that I heard you mention this title on one of your episodes on Hoaxbusters. But the book is called Acid Dreams: The Complete Social History of LSD, the CIA, the 60s, and Beyond. And the authors are Martin Lee and Bruce Schlein. You're familiar with this book, aren't you, John?
Yes, I am. And I will say that when it comes to whitewashing the entire LSD CIA thing, it does provide you with a lot of information, but that book is a total whitewash.
Yeah.
Like I said, you can glean a lot of good information
from
it. Yes,
historical data, yeah.
But yes, if you were looking for some truthful account of how it is, when I say that, when I use that phrase, the LSD slipped on a banana peel and whipped the daisy, it accidentally got out, I'm actually thinking of the book Acid Dreams, because that's pretty much
that's their argument.
That's what they promote in it. But I like I said, I read that book many, many years ago. And the first thing I thought is, this book is a bunch of hogwash, but I sure did learn a lot from it. So,
yes, yes.
So, yes, I would say there's not, if you're looking for actual books, there's not really any I can technically recommend anymore, but I can recommend that you go check out Jan Irving's article, Manufacturing the Deadhead, and that is a great article. Or you can go look at Dave McGowan's Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, The Birth of the Hippie Movement and the Dark Art of the Hippie Dream, I think it's called.
Weird Scenes in the Canyon?
Yeah, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. It's basically the story of Laurel Canyon and how how a lot of the people who were these hippie icons were actually connected to military intelligence.
Wow. Oh, man. Now, you're not talking... You're not talking Jerry Rubin or Abby Hoffman.
Well, are you? Well, Jerry Rubin, just in himself, I mean, what did he end up becoming? A Wall Street stockbroker.
Well, there you go.
That right there. But yeah, if you, I mean, just one example, that's Dave McGowan's research. We've interviewed Dave McGowan. You can hear that on our Hoaxbusters call. But just one mention, you know, Jim Morrison, his dad was the... was Admiral Stephen Morrison, and he was actually the captain of the ship that was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Really?
So you have to ask yourself a question that, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident has turned out to be completely and totally fake.
Yes, that's
nothing
right.
Even,
yeah.
Nothing even happened. Yeah, nothing even happened there at all. So
it was just a pretext, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a reason to be able to go into Vietnam.
Yep.
But you're telling me that the guy who was running the ship for this big fake event that was used to get us into the Vietnam War, it was okay for his son to be running around as the top hippie icon of the day, the icon of the anti-war movement?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Sounds a little fishy.
Yeah.
Plus, you never ever hear about the fact that Jim Morrison's dad was Admiral Stephen Morrison.
That's right.
It's something that's kind of hidden way back in the history book. So, yeah, there's a ton of people like that where you would never know about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody from Frank Zappa to John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, they all come from military intelligence families. Very strange.
Very strange.
Way too many of it for to be a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Dave McGowan's resources as well as John Irving. So, listeners, I'd make use of those and follow and check out those resources. So it was no accident. It was no accident that the drugs were introduced then, John. Where did it go from there?
Well, basically, if you go back into the 1950s, even before that, like I was saying, in the jazz age, they introduced opium into the culture through the jazz age, the jazz movement. Jazz was the vehicle of the day. And there's all sorts of things. There's all sorts of things we could digress off into just in analyzing jazz.
Yeah. You're talking about the Beats and Harlem and all that.
That, you know, back in the big band era. But just the rhythm. You know, there's all sorts of psychological implications with the rhythm of jazz. It's very freeing to the mind. It's very psychologically produces a very free feeling because it's a very free flowing. It's improvisational, in its form. It's got a syncopated rhythm, and this does things to you psychologically. There's a lot of research that I've read about that. It's very hard to articulate it though. But so that was a vehicle. You think about the popular songs of the days, Cole Porter, Cole Porter went to Yale, and he was a member of the Scroll and Key Society, which is the other society there at Yale besides Skull and Bones. And he wrote a song called Anything Goes.
Yes.
He also wrote a song called Let's Do It.
Yeah.
And, everybody knows what Let's Do It meant. They used to know what Let's Do It meant back in the 20s as well.
Sure.
So these were very, quote-unquote, free times. That was all being promoted. Free love, mini skirts. Sound familiar?
Yep.
So they tried it. They tried it out in the 20s, and then there's all sorts of digression we could talk about when we move up into World War II. But we won't talk about that. Post World War II, you have a generation of people who are raised in affluence. And so you have a lot of what you call, you know, what the communists like to call the bourgeois, the upper class, you know, the upper middle class or something like that.
Yeah.
And so so then you have the beat generation, the beats and all that type of stuff. Like I said, if you go look at the information, Greenwich Village
in New York was basically being run by the CIA as a laboratory.
Yes.
For testing out the jazz culture, and then slowly but surely introducing the LSD into it and the psychedelic.
Yeah.
And like I said, heroin and jazz are synonymous with each other since the inception. So, but it was not to the point in our culture to where the person who would casually listen to a Charlie Parker record was going to then go start doing heroin. That was not how it was. That's not how it worked.
Right.
But once you get into the 1960s, you have this culture, you have this group of youths who have been molded to emulate everything that their idols do.
Yes.
Right?
Yep, that's right.
And that's how we've all been molded today, on down into the present time, is you want to have the sunglasses like, you know, the hip-hop rapper, I want to wear shoes like Kanye West or whatever it is. That is how we've been molded since that time period.
Yeah.
And also, if your favorite rap star or rock star is a pot smoker, then you're going to be a pot smoker, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing with the drug culture in the 60s. And it's interesting because if you go behind the scenes, what you are going to find is you're going to find a whole lot of psychologists, psychiatrists, anthropologists, and these are the people who are coming up with all the ideas, and a lot of it's centered around the MKUltra program. And the MKUltra program has, you know, through movies and fiction and all that, it's kind of been sold to us as this project that was, you know, all about creating mind-controlled soldiers who are going to go, you know, get a phone call, and then they're going to go shoot somebody.
Right, right.
Turns out that's not really the case. Now, some people might argue that. They might say, well, yeah, look at all, I think that there's mind control killers used in these shootings today.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The only problem is most of these shootings today turn out to be fake.
Right.
So you wouldn't need a mind controlled soldier to go shoot anybody.
Mm. Right.
You just need an actor to pretend to shoot somebody. That's right. Basically what you find out when you do a lot of the research. But here's the thing. MKUltra was a project on how to get people in the general population of America, and then, you know, essentially much later worldwide, how to create a drug culture where you are dependent on drugs, you are always using drugs, drugs are going to be your go-to thing to alleviate your pain.
Yeah.
How are we going to shift culture? How are we going to change culture? How are we going to overthrow all the old values and bring in all the new values?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I got a little quote here. There was a lady, she was very famous, and I think even the last time I was on with you, I read another quote from one of her books. Her name is Margaret Mead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Margaret Mead was married to Gregory Bateson, and Gregory Bateson, it's well known. He was in the MKUltra project, as well as being one of the inventors of cybernetics.
Really? Mm.
Yes. And so Margaret Mead was married to him. She wrote a little book. It's pretty well known. It's called A Study of the Generation Gap. I think it should be titled A Study of the Manufactured Generation Gap.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what they were doing. How would you even know that there was a generation gap until Margaret Mead told you so?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. There's some interesting little quotes in here, and you have to find them curious, knowing that Margaret Mead herself is a culture creator, a cultural manipulator. And basically Margaret Mead's job was to study indigenous cultures and shill for UNESCO and try to figure out ways to gradually put things into indigenous cultures that weren't there before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you used a lot of those studies to figure out how to do that to the West as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here's what she says on page 55 of her book, Culture and Commitment, A Study of the Generation Gap. It says, it can also occur when conquered populations are required to learn the language and ways of the conqueror.
when adults adopt a new religion and teach children new ideals that they themselves never experienced as children and adolescents, or it may happen as a purposeful step in a revolution that establishes itself through the introduction of new and different lifestyles for the young. The conditions for change to a configurative type of culture becomes increasingly common as civilization becomes more advanced. As availability of greater material power made it possible for the members of one society to conquer, enslave, or change the beliefs of other societies and to control or direct the behavior of the younger generation.
Wow.
Often, however, configuration as a style lasts only for a short period. In situations which the cultural style of the most powerful group is basically post-figurative, members of a conquered group may have had no certain models except their peers, and their lifestyle may be configurative. Yet their children may be completely assimilated into a different but still wholly post-figurative culture, like the children born into the cooperative communities of Israel, for example. Mm-hmm. They're talking about the kibbutzim. But see, what the point I was making about reading that was that lady and the people that she works with, they fully understand how to manipulate behavior and culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and then you find out that her husband works on the MKUltra mind control projects.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it's very strange that you have all these people who have all this advanced knowledge of how to control and manipulate cultures and behavior, mm-hmm. and they are also studying the effects of psychedelic drugs on people,
yes.
and doing all sorts of weird and bizarre tests to see how people react to psychedelics.
Yes. Clearly it was a central component of their research then, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's not anything that could have slipped past them. Whoops, we missed that one, that LSD thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the same thing could apply, and this has been something that the government has denied for a long time, John. But the CIA, it is my opinion, based on the research that I've read and looked at, is that the CIA is directly responsible for introducing cocaine, crack cocaine, and heroin into the black communities of Southern California, predominantly Los Angeles, and they used the gangs in the 60s to do that, the Crips and the Bloods, and they were selling drugs to the gangs, and it anyway, it's a long and sordid history, and I wonder if you could comment on that from what you've discovered in your research. It's not just a fantasy that the black community has invented when they are pointing fingers at the U.S. government and specifically the CIA to say, you did this to us.
Yeah, that came out a long time ago. If you believe the testimonies of the interviews, you can find a freeway Ricky Ross.
Yes.
He was the biggest crack cocaine dealer in Los Angeles in the 1980s.
Yeah.
I do have a friend who... he's a much older black gentleman, and he said that his brother was a crackhead, and that he actually used to hang out at Freeway Ricky Ross's house.
Hmm.
That's what he tells me. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard. So I know for a fact that that he did exist, and that is his story, and that he went to jail and all that stuff. But allegedly, he did not. He was not aware that he was actually doing the dirty work of the CIA
At the time.
But yeah, that's what he said. That's what he says. He says he was just a dealer, and which that could be true.
Sure,
that could quite possibly be true.
Yeah.
The connection and the cooperation was made through a series of articles that were written by a reporter for him. I'm going off memory here. I haven't looked into that stuff in quite a while, but a reporter by the name of Gary Webb.
Yes, yeah. I recall that name, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wrote a book many years ago that I read many years ago called Dark Majesty.
Yes, yeah.
And I don't watch movies anymore, but I believe they made a movie out of this guy's life recently.
Yeah, yeah. That's something. Let's see. Is did he write something? Dark Alliance too? John,
yeah,
is it something there?
Yeah, Dark Alliance was the name of the article that he was
writing. Okay, yeah. Now, interesting about Gary Webb, he allegedly committed suicide, right?
Yeah, allegedly. Allegedly, that whole thing was there where he shot himself twice in the head with a shotgun.
Yes.
I don't know about that whole situation, but what I do know is I read that book, and it's basically corroborating separately what Ricky Ross was saying with the connections from the CIA through, you know, Nicaragua and Colombia, making sure all of the cocaine got over here. And then, you know, there's been stories for years and years about how they would drop off brochures or flyers into the ghettos.
Yes.
On how to make crack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That they would so that's been around a long time. And like I said, my friend who's much older than me and lived through that era said that was actually true. You could find flyers and brochures about how to make crack cocaine. I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't put it past anybody. And
yeah,
like you said, the gangs were the movers and the shakers of all that type of stuff.
Yeah,
pretty much always have been.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's interesting, and you mentioned Nicaragua and Colombia. What's the connection there? What I'm asking is those countries, and especially early on, Honduras. From what I've read, the nation of Honduras was utilized in the CIA's drug trafficking schemes, and I believe Nicaragua and Colombia were also utilized as drug trafficking and arms sales, weren't they?
Right. Once again, you have the players of the Skull and Bone. You have, you know, George H.W. Bush. You also have another Yalie who was an Oxford Rhodes Scholar, was Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
You have all that being run out of Mena, Arkansas. That's well documented.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have those two guys knee-deep in drugs. Like I said, it you know, carried over from the same old British Empire running it way back when.
Yeah.
And like I said, like the research has been out there for years. It's really easy to find that stuff. But one thing that I would like to bring light to is that Iran-Contra and the stuff that you hear about Fast and Furious and all that type of stuff, I think those are distractionary things.
Really?
I think the only reason you hear about those things at all is because it's to take you off of the fact that the drugs are meant for you. The drugs are meant for your culture. The drugs are meant for your country.
So the media is trying to incite us then to be outraged at this clandestine arms sale and forget the fact that the drugs are being dumped in America. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, look at the parallels of Fast and Furious and Iran-Contra. They're almost the same story, just recycled.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a totally recycled story, and they do that so often. So often you get the same scandal, and you're thinking to yourself, like, didn't this happen? They're trying to make a new fake Cold War with Russia, and you're thinking, we just had a Cold War with Russia in the 80s. I mean, doesn't anybody remember this? But see, everybody has a short memory.
Mm-hmm.
They don't remember all of these scandals. So I think they're manufactured scandals, and once again, the purpose is to get you off of the, you know, no one, you know, everybody's going to be up in arms over, you know, some gun running going on in Mexico or, you know, selling AK-47s to Iran back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And you're so focused on that, you don't even realize that the drugs are being distributed all over and it's even furthering the drug culture.
Yeah, yeah. The media has become a master at the sleight of hand, haven't they?
Yeah, they always were. I mean, for the most part. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, I mean, is it mastery? or is it because we're becoming dumber?
Well,
it would be one thing to say, man, the media is getting smarter, but it's actually the opposite.
Yeah.
It's actually, we're getting, and you know, the thing of it is actually humans are not dumb. We are not dumb. It's just we are really smart at stuff that we shouldn't be smart about. It's like when I have a conversation with someone at work,
mm-hmm.
and I think to myself that, you know, it's really sad that this guy doesn't even know anything about reality at all.
Yeah.
But yet he knows all of the sports scores from the previous day. He knows all the statistics.
Yep.
He knows, you know, what Kobe Bryant's favorite, you know, bath soap is.
Mm.
But he doesn't know anything about reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, he's a smart guy, the general person out there. But they know a lot about stuff that doesn't even matter.
So we really are living in a matrix.
It appears, you see, that's what you have to ask yourself. I mean, what is your reality?
Yeah.
Is your reality the fake bling bling reality, the projected reality out into, you know, I mean, if you think about it, Our reality is becoming meshed with technology,
mm-hmm.
even in,
right.
in our mindscape.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it has to do with the scape of the mind.
Yeah, good point.
You know, I'd say for a good portion of people spend a lot of their time inside technology, because
mm-hmm.
they're looking at their phones, they're watching television, they're watching films,
mm-hmm.
and that in and of itself is a entirely different world altogether. It's not reality. It's not being outside. It's not, you know, seeing a tree. You're gonna see trees on a screen in a movie.
Mm-hmm. You've been talking to Jay Dyer a lot, haven't you?
we have had some interesting conversations, that's for sure.
Yeah, because the whole time you're describing that, I'm thinking Tron, any number of movies come to mind. But really, is it because we've become so steeped in materialism that we're apathetic to anything that doesn't meet these new created needs that have been placed in our mind by other people? And I guess that's a philosophical way of saying we're actually frogs in a pot boiling to death, aren't we?
Yeah, there is a positive outlook that we can have about this. It's not anything that you have to be upset about. I mean, maybe you can't help it. You're going to get upset and depressed for a minute, but you can get over it real quickly,
mm-hmm.
because what you have to come to terms with is that you becoming an individual and learning about individualism,
mm-hmm.
and that in and of itself can be dangerous, and I would caution against what I would call transhumanist individualism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because a lot of that gets pushed, you know, a lot of individualism is being pushed in a very Luciferian aspect as well.
Yeah.
But yes, you need to break, as much as the old cultures were overthrown, and I didn't agree with those old cultures, I don't agree with the new culture either.
Right.
You see, and that's what we have to realize. We have to realize that when they were overthrowing the old ideas, well, the old ideas, they weren't that great. But that doesn't mean just because you overthrow the old idea that the new idea is the best thing for you either.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the best things you can do is you can say no to the TV, you could say no to the movies,
mm-hmm.
say no to the smartphones and all that stuff. And, I mean, it's not bad to embrace aspects of technology, but you can't just embrace it blindly and just say this is good.
Yeah.
You need to be cautious with it. It's,
yes.
it's like um, it's it's like a knife or a gun. I mean, you don't take the knife or the gun out and play with it. You only use it when you need to.
Yeah. 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 Very good points, John.
There is a book that I just recently found out about. It's called Expanded Cinema. It was written in the 1970s, and it was by a gentleman by the name of Gene Youngblood. He writes in here, and he says, television's scientific invention has accelerated the process of freeing humanity from its slave complex to an extraordinary degree. The young realize, as their elders do not, that humanity can do and can afford to do anything it needs to that it knows how to do. Those who ignorantly think of themselves as well-to-do conservative elite are in fact so slave complex that they are shocked when the younger generation throws aside their clothes and the cars of the distinction and abandoning their make-believe mansions, which are their old conquerors' castles, congregate in hundreds of thousands in shameless innocent bands on vast beaches and meadows. It is not an unspannable generation gap that has occurred, but an emancipation of youth from yesterday's slave complex reflex. This has been brought about solely by the proliferation of knowledge. The medium is the message, is the message only of yesterday's middle-class elite. It said, never mind the mind, it's the body that counts. It's the physical that can be possessed. Mm-hmm. To hell with the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. You can possess a physical brain, but not the universally free mind and thoughts. Leave that to the intellectuals. Now, see, once again, what I was reading that for was to point out that I don't necessarily agree with what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what is given to us.
Yeah.
You either agree with the old culture or you agree with the new culture that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the dialectical opposites that you are given to believe in. You have to pick a side.
Yeah.
Right? But see, I don't pick a side. I don't buy into either of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we need to do. You can't go back and say, hey, the nuclear family is a great thing. You see?
Mm-hmm.
Because the nuclear family in and of itself was a creation
mm-hmm.
to destroy the idea of the extended family.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when people hearken back to the idea of that, they're really pining for something that was given to them in the first place to break off the idea of larger family.
Yes. And just for the sake of our listeners, John, you mentioned extended family and nuclear family. Would you describe what you mean by those terms? I understand what you're saying, but I want our listeners to fully grasp what you just said. It's very important.
Sure. Yeah, the extended family is when families prior to, I'd say, World War II, everybody helped raise the children,
mm-hmm.
The grandparents,
yeah.
Sometimes aunts and uncles. The family lived in close proximity to each other.
Yeah.
And then by the time the 1950s came out, the cultural creators changed the culture to where people were centered more around, they were centered more around of a corporate type living scape where, you moved out for the sake of your job, you moved somewhere. Or for whatever reason, you moved
mm-hmm.
away from your extended family, you moved
mm-hmm.
to another state,
mm-hmm.
and you basically kept it down to about three children.
Yes.
At the most.
So instead of the extended family, it became mom, dad, and the children without any outside family members.
That's right. And the amount of children came down in size as well, because people,
yes.
Like we talked about last time, people used to have, six, seven children.
Yes.
It was no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the 1960s came in, people were having three or less.
That's right.
That's where we are today.
Yes. And you were seen as some kind of oddity if you desired to have more than the two or three children. If you had more than two or three children, they'd want to know, were you Mormon or Catholic or what?
Yes.
What's your...
Oh, yes, yes. That would always come into play. I'm one of five. And so even in the 1990s, people were asking me if I was Mormon and or Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be, no, I'm neither, but we just have a big family. And I'm like, it's not even that big.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Well, John, give our listeners the website where they can go and listen to you and Chris and your afternoon commute Hoax Busters calls.
Sure. It's at hoaxbusterscall.com. That's hoaxbusterscall.com. Chris, that's Chris Kendall's website. That's not my website. But if you want to get in contact with me, you can contact Chris at Hoax Busters there, and he'll relay the message to me, I'm sure. But yeah, we do a weekly show. It's called The Afternoon Commute.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris and I get together. We interview different people from all different viewpoints. And sometimes him and I just have a conversation on our own and talk about different things. But yeah, check it out. You can check out past episodes as well. We have a lot of interesting stuff, and we've been doing it for almost two years now. So there's a lot of material there, and it mainly centers around culture and cultural changes and psychology, anthropology, a lot of things along those lines. And it's basically just anything Chris and I find interesting.
Yes, yeah. Very, very good podcast. I listened to it myself, and they interview some very interesting guests. And in fact, I even like it when Chris just calls people up to ask them questions about things and kind of puts them on the spot, and they don't know how to answer.
those are great. I love that.
Yeah.
I always encourage him to do that.
Well, John, it's been another great chat with you. I appreciate you taking the time to join me here, and we'll loop around and try to schedule another one in the not-too-distant future, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Can I leave you with a quote?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay, this is from a book. It's called The Making of a Counterculture. It's by a guy named Theodore Roszak, who was a graduate of UCLA in Princeton. And he says here in this book, it was written in 1967 or 68, he says, within a wider context, the quest of the young for psychedelic adventures begins to look like the symptom of a much larger social development in which their rejected elders participate. The fact is, our society is well on its way toward becoming distressingly drug dependent. The reliance on chemical agents to control the various functions of the organism is now a standard feature of what we regard as health.
That's very, very true. Very true.
He was making that observation in 1967.
Wow.
And even though I don't agree with everything Mr. Roszak talks about, because he's more of a acolyte of the Frankfurt School, it's the same thing with a lot of the Frankfurt School guys. They talk about a lot of stuff that I agree with, but I don't agree with their overall viewpoint.
Right.
And that observation was being made in 1967, and he already saw what was going to happen as a result of the psychedelic culture.
Yes, and it's been multiplied exponentially since he wrote those words, for sure.
Right. You know, there was one more thing I did want to mention real quick.
Please do.
You know, we were warned, quote-unquote warned, by Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley would go all over. He would go on Mike Wallace's TV show. He gave that famous speech at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And these guys did a lot of warning, just like President Eisenhower, you know, warned people about the military-industrial complex and the technocratic elite.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that both Aldous Huxley and President Eisenhower, well, they were giving us these quote-unquote warnings? You know, people put a lot of emphasis on both these gentlemen as being some, great, like I said, guys doing a good deed because they care about you so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know that both of these gentlemen were having meetings with all of the people that who proliferated the drug culture, who created the drug culture, the psychiatrist, the psychologist, the anthropologist, one in particular that Jan Ervin talks about is R. Gordon Wasson.
Yeah.
And both Eisenhower and Huxley while they were giving these warnings of both of these things coming into view, they were actively participating in meetings with all of the people who were actually making those things come into fruition. And so I think a lot of this is about that you're going to get a warning as to what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to get it from the people who are actually putting it into culture.
Wow.
And they're not warning you because they care about you. They're warning you as kind of a like Roman maxim type thing, like, buyer beware.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. We may have to pick up that thread again and explore that a little bit more next time, John, because that, boy, is that the conscience crying out to do the right thing, even though you're part of the process of implementing these things? There's a lot we could talk about there with the psyche for sure.
Yeah, that might even venture over into Jay Dyer's area once again, talking about what Twilight language is. Revelation of the method. And
yes.
You have to tell people what you're going to do. It's kind of an esoteric witchcraft type thing as well, where you tell people what you're going to do before you do it.
That's right.
And if the people aren't smart enough to pick up on it, then too bad for them.
Too bad for them. Yeah, that's right. And we see a lot of that in the movies too, for sure.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A lot of symbolism, and
sure.
Yeah, we sure do. Yep.
That's a whole other podcast, my friend.
It sure is, John. But that's good stuff, and I think folks need to hear it, and then they need to research it and investigate it for themselves. So, it's like I tell people all the time, John, right from the pulpit. Listen, you don't have to believe a word I say. The evidence is out there. The facts are out there. Go research it yourself and see for yourself, and then you'll become convinced that what I'm saying. It's true.
Absolutely.
John, thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate the conversation, as always.
I appreciate it as well, and I'm looking forward to doing it again soon.
I'll circle back with you, and we'll get that scheduled. God bless you, my friend.
God bless you. Have a good day.
You do the same. Thank you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.